I want to thank you very much for inviting me. Indeed, it is a tremendous zechut and a tremendous thrill for me to be able to be here. And someone asked me as I was coming in what we were going to discuss. And I told him, honestly, I'm really not 100% sure. I do this sometimes. It's a kind of sense of, as you kind of get warmed up, there's different ideas that come out. And I think that the feel in the air and the kind of vibes that you feel in the crowd would puts me in a much better mood than probably I would have prepared for. So therefore, I thank you. A while ago, there was a person in Eretz Yisrael whose daughter was very ill. And the Israeli doctors essentially gave up hope. They said, there's nothing more we can do for her. But they told her that there is a doctor in Columbia Presbyterian that perhaps, maybe, just maybe, he can do something for her. This man spoke not a word of English, and he had no money. And for him to fly from Jerusalem to come to New York, to come to Columbia Presbyterian, to make the arrangements, the financial arrangements, the appointments, was like equivalent of telling someone to go up to the moon. It was just, it seemed totally impossible, totally beyond his reach. There is one man in Eretz Yisrael who arranges these things, but it's extremely difficult to get to him. He's a very, very busy person. He's always flying around the country, meeting with doctors. And our friend, let's call him Moshe. Moshe is trying so hard to get an appointment with him, and he just can't get an appointment. And he's begging. He says, my daughter is in front of my eyes. I see she's every day deteriorating. Please help me. Can't get an appointment. We're trying. He speaks to the secretary. Finally, one day he lives in Yerushalayim in Jerusalem. And he's told, if you come right now to Bnei Brak, from Jerusalem to Bnei Brak is a good hour drive, even Israeli driving, it's an hour drive. He said, come. But you got to be here within an hour. If you're here within the hour, he can see you. He can speak to you. He raced downstairs, flagged down the first taxi, jumped in. He said, get me to Bnei Brak in 45 minutes. The man turned around. He said, Chabibi, it's impossible. He pulled out 300 shkolim, and that taxi took off. You know, the two exhaust pipes came out on all different sides, and they were just racing down the road, curving and twerving, burning rubber, turning on two tires, you know, crashing through farms, people running in all different directions. You know what they say about Israeli taxi drivers? It's not that they drive too fast, they fly too low. And he's just pulling through, and he pulls up and screeches to a stop. And the person is like, he takes the money from him, and he jumps out and runs up and bangs on the door. And you see he's sweating and he's petrified. He saw, you know, the life in his hands. He went through a very difficult trip, and he's banging on the door. He's all sweating. He says, I made it on time. Please let me in. And they come out, and they tell him, I'm sorry that person, he thought he would be able to be here for an hour, but he had to leave 20 minutes ago. And he says, I don't believe this. I don't believe this happened to me. And he's fainting. His knees turn into jelly. And he starts shaking. And he says, I'm going to faint. I can't believe this happened. And they bring him a cup of water. And as he's about to make the bracha on that cup of water, he stops and he says, Baruch Atah Hashem, blessed are you, God. And he says, you know, God, you're so kind. We don't have to make an appointment with you. I'm trying to make an appointment with this guy for 4 weeks, and I run like the devil, and we screech and fly, and we terrorize every single Israeli road to get it on time. We come pulling up with smoke coming out of the engine, and he's gone. And you, God, you know what this means? That any time I could open a Siddur, any time I could open a Tehillim, and I could just go over and say, Baruch Atah Hashem, blessed are you, God, face to face. He was really getting all. He said, never mind all these askanim. Never mind all these people that help. Forget about them. It's between me and you, Hashem. Please, save my daughter. They're like running over. You okay? You okay, sir? Everything all right? And he makes his bracha. He drinks the water and he comes home. He says to his wife, we missed him. He wasn't here. I says, oh no, what now? He says, I have a feeling that now things are going to be okay. And sure enough, as time went on, they saw a tremendous change in his daughter. She was getting better and better and better and better. And the doctor said, it's rare, it's 1 out of 50 that it heals on its own, but apparently she's okay, she'll be all right. From this point on, we can handle it right here in Israel. And his wife says to him, what did you do? He said, I made a shahakol. So she says, for that you have to spend 300 shkolim and go to the Bnei Brak? You could have made a shahakol right here. He said, that shehakol that I made there, I could have not made right here. You know, Reb Chaim of Volozhin, the Nefesh HaChaim, was one of the great disciples of the Vilna Gaon, said that since Sheshet Yimei Bereshit, since the creation of the world, until the end of the world, no two Shemona Esrei's, no two prayers are alike. And he explains why. Every single one of us, each individual of us, are different people. Just like if I put my finger on this stender, as we call it, and somebody else would come and swipe it and take a DNA test, it would not match anyone else. The same is true in regard to our soul. That God created 600,000 basic souls that are subdivided. But every single one of you is a human being in the eyes of God and is an only child. Because there is no one else in the entire universe that is like you. Which means as follows, that when you open up a Siddur, or you open up a Psalms, a Tehillim, and you say, God help me. So God says, my only child is calling me. There is no one else that has the same DNA that you have, and there is no one else that has the same Neshama that you have. But it goes further than that. There is no moment in your life that you are the same. Just like very clearly when you're a baby, it's very different than when you get older. And we all know as we mature how life changes. Somebody once said, if you want to see how life changes, look at an invitation. Usually what's the first invitation a person is on? His bar mitzvah, right? When he turns 13 years old. He's king of the world. The world is his. And his name is in big, bold letters in the middle of the invitation. The world is mine. It's mine. And his parents go out and they buy him the fancy suit. And he's getting presents. And he's carrying home all these gifts. The world is his. He does nothing for this bar mitzvah. So the parents work hard. His name is in the middle. Okay? Fast forward another 10 years. He's getting married. A little different now. He has to find someone to get married. The ups and downs, the disappointments, the ones he wanted didn't want him, the ones that wanted him he didn't want. And finally he gets married. Now his name isn't alone anymore in the invitation. Now it's shared with someone else. See, more work, and it's not so easy. Fast forward another 20 years, he's marrying off a child. The headaches of marrying off a child. My son, my daughter is dating. Oh no, not him, not her, no. So finally, then you have all the chavot, you have to pay for the wedding. Oh my goodness, you go out of your mind. How many sleepless nights? Where's your name? It's at the bottom of the invitation. So you see what life is as you get older, how life begins to change. It costs more, it's more difficult to get on, and it's kind of less and less as things move. Finally, if you ever marry off a grandchild, so they do you this big favor sometimes. They stick your name on the other side of the invitation. And they say, we also, you know, invite people. That's life. Life changes. As we get older, are you the same person you were last year? You definitely are not. If you think about all the experiences you went through. My daughter went to camp. I called her up. I said, everything okay? She says, Dad, I feel like I never left. I said, you remember what you went through in eighth grade? The ups and the downs, the teachers? Oh, never mind. She said, I left. We sometimes lack out our experience in the middle, but you're not the same person you were last year. When you open up a siddur, when you say Shema, when you put on tefillin one morning, you're a different person. You're not the same person you were yesterday. And just like you can clearly tell the difference between someone who's 5 months old and someone who's 50 years old, the truth is biologically we change every second. It's just that it goes so slow, we don't perceive it. But the reality is you're a different person. So therefore, says Reb Chaim of Volozhin, when I will daven ma'ariv, when I daven the evening prayer tonight, arvit, I'm not the same person I was last night. Inevitably, there were experiences in the last 24 hours that changed my life. So not only when you pick up a siddur, when you light a Shabbos candle, are you the only person in the world lighting that Shabbos candle because no one else like you? This is the only Shabbat in the world. Because last week you were a different person, and next week you're going to be a different person. Okay. So the Chiddush Yerim said, that is the meaning the Mishnah says, im ein anili mili. If I don't do it for myself, if I don't have the relationship of God that I have to on my own, no one else can do it for me. Because I'm the only one in the world. V'im lo achshav ematai. And if I don't do it now, when am I going to do it? I'm a certain human being now. That shahakol that person made that night, There's a time in our life, each and every one of us are going to make that shehakol. Only one time. Every time you make a baracha, when we're going to come up after 120 years, God says to us, where were you on this day? You were the only person in the world. And you were the only person in this emotional state at that moment to pray. I was waiting for you. Who are we? Okay, so I'm speaking a little bit in riddles. Let's get a little bit more practical. Somebody once said, how can you tell the difference between a Jew and a Gentile? There's some basic differences. Listen to this and you'll see I'm right. Ever watch two gentlemen standing next to a fax machine or a computer as a paper is coming out? Generally, a Gentile waits till the entire paper comes out and walks away with it. You want to know if someone's Jewish? As soon as the paper starts coming out, he starts pulling it. You're going to see. It is almost, I'm telling you, it's like foolproof. Watch, if you've ever gone to a, you ever standing in by an elevator waiting for an elevator to come, you see five, six people standing there, they're waiting for someone to press the button. Everyone is standing, right? People come, they wait. A Jew comes, he presses the button again. He doesn't believe anyone else pressed the button. That's usually how it goes. We have to take matters into our own hands. You ever watch a Gentile gentleman walk by a sign that says wet paint? He usually steps back. You watch a Jew walks by, he touches it. I want to see whether that's wet or not. I don't believe. We have to take matters into our own hands. I mean, today there are cell phones, but if you ever watch on the public phones, easy way to know if he's a Jew, he puts his finger in to see if the quarter came back. That was all the time. You've ever watched this? No, this is honestly true. You ever watch a Gentile mail a letter? He goes over, puts the letter in the mailbox and walks away. You ever watch a Jew mail a letter? Five times, he opens up the mailbox to see if the letter went in. As if there is this, we have this Misorah from Sinai, that there's an angel that comes down, you know, and steals the letter somehow between, because we check it six times when it goes. Right? I was once saying this to a friend of mine. We were driving someplace, and he was saying, nah, you're exaggerating. And finally I said, wow, it's starting to rain. He sticks his hand out of the window and goes, no. It's pouring. The windshield wipers are driving. There is a natural tendency that we have to try to control. To try to take matters into our own hands. Now, I want to share with you a little story which... Actually, someone reminded me that he heard me earlier, and I think I said the story then, so I beg his apologies. But I think it's appropriate for what I would like to set the stage for tonight. So last Chalamot Pesach, in the intermediary days of Passover, so, you know, I have a house, I have 14 kids, B'li Ayin Hara, not all home at the same time, many of them are married, they're home with grandchildren. So my wife asked me to please take them out for a short while. Actually, she strongly suggested I take them out for a short while. It was like Friday afternoon. It was like the second day of Yom Tov. It was the eve of Yom Tov. We had many guests coming. She said, do me a favor, please, you know, take them out. I said, everybody into the van. We're going on a trip. Where can you go 5 hours before Yom Tov, before the holiday? We're going to go. So we start driving around the block a couple of times. And finally, someone says to me, and one of my children says to me, where are we going? I said, it's a surprise. One of my more older, astute children says, Ta, Daddy, is it a surprise to you also? I said, be quiet. I said, as far as Mommy is concerned, we can go around the block 15 times and then go home. So you know what I mean? So don't push this, okay? So where are we going? So I have this grand idea. I said, you know what? Let's go to the airport. I said, let's go to the airport. Why the airport? Where are we flying to? We're not flying anywhere. My cheshbon, what was I thinking? The airport is for free, you know. Every good Jew thinks, if you don't fly anywhere, I forgot you have to pay for parking. And I figured it would be a very good educational experience for the children. So we go to the airport, we get out. And as we're walking, this same daughter, this clever daughter, says to me, she says in a very nice way, she says, Dad, like, what she meant to say is there's no other normal from Orthodox people in the airport 2 hours before Yom Tov. And you're like the only one. I was dressed, the way a Hasid dresses during Yom Tov. We have the shrama, like the fur hat and the long blue, you know, black silk robe. I said, people are looking at us. She may be like, you know, we're the only ones here. And it's just a bit uncomfortable. I understood what she said. I began to think whether the airport was a good idea or not. Especially if I reminded myself, you do have to pay for parking. So I said, you know what? We're here. Let's just go. Let's look around and let's see where we can go. So we continued on, and I said, you know what, let's go up on the air train. It goes around and around, and it's free again, and you know. So we're about to walk up the stairs. She says, Dad, maybe not, you know, like, you know, we're the only Orthodox people in the airport, like, and everyone's looking at us. I said, don't worry, let's go, we'll try. We walk up to the platform. What should I tell you? All of Borough Park and Williamsburg are there. You know what I mean? That whole platform, Passover Pesach, that whole platform is full of orange peels and empty macaroon cans. It really felt like home. And all the trains are packed with kids waving at each other, and we get in, and everybody knows, somebody, the poor person had to travel from terminal to terminal, didn't know what hit them, and we're on this train, and we're going round and round. The kids are really having a blast. They're enjoying it. They're waving to the kids in their class that pass on the oncoming train. And it takes about 10 minutes for the train to make the circuit around the airport. So at one point, I want to go home already. The kids say, no, we're having such a good time. We'll stay. And, you know, it's getting close. I got to go. Finally, the door opens up at one of the terminals. A gentleman walks in uniform. Clearly, he is a pilot. So I say to one of my kids, please stand up for the gentleman. So the man says, no, it's okay. He says, I've been sitting the last 16 hours. I don't mind standing alone. He looks around the train. He sees packed with little boys with side curls with everything. Like he's wondering where he landed. I said, no. I said, it's okay. You landed in America. It's okay. He said, I got scared for a moment, you know. And maybe the computer was off, you know. Israel, America, I don't know. He said, no. It's fine. So we have this nice, pleasant discussion. And finally, he says to me, you know, and I'm keeping all my kids like at bay. I'm trying. He says to me, Rabbi. He says, these are all your kids? They're all your kids? So I had like 6-7 kids with me. I said, what? I was a little stunned by the question. He says, I hope you don't mind my asking you. I said, are these all your kids? I said, no, they're not all my kids. I said, some are in Israel, some are home, some are... not all of them. There's some of them. Anyway, see, really? Like, he's just totally stunned. He also took an extra couple of circuits around the airport. We're having this conversation. And he goes on to tell me, he says that he's flying in from, he just flew in from Peking. One of my kids that grew up in a real Chassidus yeshiva says, where's Peking? I said, you know, it's a little further than Williamsburg, be quiet, and don't butt into the conversation. And finally, he starts telling me his life story. I don't know why this always happens to me. One of my kids also says, Pat, why does this always happen? I don't know why. I didn't ask him to tell me his life story. Anyway, he tells me he's been an international pilot for the last 20 years, he says, and that... He's been flying. He says he flies for 3 weeks and you have 1 week off. That's the way it works. So I said to him, that's not bad. You know, flying for 3 weeks and you have 1 week off. I said, that sounds good. He says, no, it's not good. He says, I live in Denver, he says. And the airline doesn't work its itinerary based on where I am. He says, if we land in you know, Australia, it takes me 2-3 days to get home, 3 days to get back. So essentially, I'm never home. And he says, you know, my wife left me already, and I have one daughter, and he doesn't know where she is. She's somewhere in the Samoan Islands in the Peace Corps, and he really has no connection with her. And he goes on, you know, with life, and he's telling me, and we're talking. And finally he says to me, listen, Rabbi, where are you flying to? So I got a little red-faced, you know. So I said to him, no, it's okay. He says, well, which terminal are you looking for? So I say to him, stupidly, I said, well, when I see it, I'll recognize it. I'm not sure. They all look the same, all terminals. So he says to me, well, he says, Rabbi, let me see your ticket, so I'll tell you where you're flying to. So I start telling him something about an electronic ticket, and, you know, I'm fumfing. Now, you notice when you lie, you chase your own tail, it just doesn't get caught. Dovesh Karim, it says, plural, there are many lies. You know, the good thing about the truth is only one truth. If there's a lie, you have to lie to cover up the lie, to cover up the lie. So finally, I said, look, I said, to be perfectly honest with you, sir, he says, yeah, he says, I'm really just going round and around on the train. So he looks at me for a while, and then I guess out of lack of saying anything really more perceptive, he says to me, why? So I said to him, okay, listen, he asked for it. I didn't start this conversation. He started the conversation. I said to him, I want to tell you something. He said, you see these kids? He said, they never saw television. I mean, maybe in a waiting room someplace, but never saw it at home. I don't have a computer at home. And... therefore, it's my job as a parent, it's incumbent upon me to give them a good time, to spend time with them. Because if I don't want them to be exposed to things they don't want them to be exposed to, I can't just let them, you know, sit around and do nothing. So therefore, I have to do this. And I need good places to take them. And I'm not going to take them to a movie or to a theater, which doesn't meet my levels of modesty and so on and so on. And I'm going on and on. He's looking at me all wide-eyed. He says, these kids never saw television? I said, no. They, you know. And I'm trying to explain to him, you know, a little bit about, in my circle, what we're all about. So I say to him, so I got to spend time with them. And I, what better time than in airports where you meet such wonderful people like pilots? So he's about to walk out. You know, we part from each other. He turns around, comes back into the train. Door closes. And he takes out his fancy Palm Pilot. He says, you know, I got to tell you something. He says, I know exactly where I am going to be for the next, you know, 6 months. He says, we're leaving 0400 hours. We're going to land, leaving here, landing 0600. I'm not into this 0600, but, you know, he knows exactly where he's going, where he's landing. We leave to the second. We land to the second. I wanted to ask him which airline he works for, because the ones I go to, I'll leave to the second, I'll land to the second. You know the story, they say there was a Hungarian Jew. He pulled up once to the, with all his suitcases. He says to the ticket agent, he says, listen here, he says, see this hat box? I want it to go to Puerto Rico. See this duffel bag? I want it to go to Belgium. You see this suitcase? I want it to go to Sacramento. She says, sir, that's impossible. He says, why you say impossible? You did it last time I flew. Anyway, so like I wanted to ask you why, you know, which airline you work for. But the bottom line is he came up with this synopsis, and that was the end of the conversation. He said to me, in all honesty, he said, you know something? He said, I fly the world, and I know to the second where I take off from and where I land. I know exactly where I'm going. And I look at my life, and I reflect on my life, and I got to tell you, I'm going nowhere. And he says, I sleep in the fanciest hotels, but I'm going nowhere. He says, you, sir, I knew I was in trouble because he switched from rabbi to sir. He said, you, sir, he says, you have no clue where you're going. Thanks. He says, but you know something? I see you with your kids, and you're going everywhere. He said, what I wouldn't give to switch with you. And with those words, he left the train. And I think that here we touch upon an extremely fundamental issue in Judaism. We live in a society, particularly Western society, that wants to make us believe that we control our destiny. That somehow there's a button out there that we could push that's going to solve all of our problems in life. What are the biggest industries in America? Insurance, credit, okay, oil, we all know about, right? No, wife says to the husband, please take me someplace expensive for a while. Says, come on, we're going. Where are we going? Pulls into the gas station. Advertising. Besides for oil, what is the biggest industries in America? Insurance, credit, and advertising. What do these three industries have in common? What they all have in common is that they let a person believe that you control the world, that somehow you can insure yourself against any kind of problem. The advertising industry wants to make you believe you deserve it, this is yours, you can have everything. So what if you have to go into debt for the rest of your life? It's yours, you can have it, buy it. What do you mean? He doesn't have it, and I have it. And there's a reason that advertising is that industry. And the credit industry, they're all three have one thing in common. Inculcates in a person, it imbues us with this idea that somehow there's a lever we can pull and a button that we could press, that we could have everything. If I can borrow just a line from my colleague, Rabbi Rietti, who says a beautiful vart. He says, you know, at the very beginnings of the credit card industry, they didn't call it credit cards. They called it debit card. Or debt card, actually. Because that's what it is. It's not credit. If you take simple accounting, you know there's credit on one side, there's debts on the other side, right? It's a debt card. They changed it because they weren't marketing that way. You can't market a debt card. You can market a credit card. Imagine if you got a letter in the mail. Guess what? $50,000 of free debt. You know, it's all yours. You can suffer for the rest of your life. So you're not going to open the envelope. But it says $50,000 of free credit. Ah, the world is mine. And you don't even have to pay interest the first 6 hours after you take the loan. Can you imagine? It's for free. So we're kind of snared and trapped into this idea that somehow the world is ours. And I think that Jews, to a certain degree, because there's this ingrained nature within us to kind of take control, hopefully in a positive way, we're trapped into this more. Now, why was your grandfather happier than you are? How come grandfather and grandmother didn't know from, you know, Prozac and therapy and, you know, the whole industry wasn't even around yet? And they generally were happier. Speak to people, what it was like growing up in a town. The reason they were happier is because they knew to start with they don't control their lives. They knew every third day was a pogrom. They knew that if they had supper, it was a tremendous thrill. So that's it. You woke up in the morning, you did your best, and you knew your life was in God's hands. If you don't expect to run your life to control your life, so therefore you're not disappointed with life, and you have an appreciation for life. I remember once listening to some of my kids talking, little ones, and one of them said about how much things cost in the grocery, they were repeating things, and one of my kids said, oh, we don't need any money when we buy in the grocery. And my eyebrows went up a little bit, and the other kid say, this is the 4-year-old, what do you mean you don't need money? No, my daddy doesn't need money, he has a phone number. A phone number? What does that mean? So I called the kid over. I said, well, what do you mean a phone number? He says, well, you know, we go to the grocery. The grocery man asks, what's your phone number? Punches it into the computer, and they put it on the bill. So this kid thinks you don't need money to buy food. You just need a phone number. He doesn't even know you have to pay for the phone number. That he doesn't know either. So I said, I better straighten these kids out. And since then, whenever I have a check to go to the grocery, which is rare, but when I do, I actually ask one of my kids to bring it in. Because I want these kids to realize, guess what? This is a gift from God. There's no guarantee from one second to the other. And I do so with the electric bill also. Now we kind of make this little ceremony about it. And we get the kids together and say, you know what? God gave us money to be able to pay. That's why you have lights. And I try to correct the vocabulary of my kids. I'm not saying I'm perfect on this, but just the mindset. You know, when I go to camp this summer, who says you're going to camp this summer? I thought I'm going. I said, I'm going to try. I'm going to try. As soon as I pay up last year's, I convince them to take you on credit for the next year, you'll go. But you know something? Why are you saying it as a sure thing? He says, Dad, are you trying to depress us? I said, no, I'm trying to make you happy. Why? Why? Because when you're absolutely certain things are going to happen the way you want it, guess what? Life is going to be very disappointing. But if you're trained to start with, maybe yes, maybe not, then when it comes, you're going to appreciate it. So when a kid says, I need soda. No, you don't. But you promised us soda. What do you mean you need? You want soda. You want soda? Okay. Listen to the way kids talk. I mean, I teach 8th grade. Okay? I'm like in the trenches. Had a fellow in my house from UCLA. He came over. He's learning about Yiddishkeit. And he's telling the kids about his experiences. We went to find the thrill in life. He said he went bungee jumping. I can't tell you, I've shared that experience. Something to do with jumping off a cliff connected to a rubber band or something, I don't know. He said he went parachuting. You know, the guys that went skydiving. Guy told the rabbi he went skydiving. He says, why? He says, Rabbi, I wanted to feel close to God. And jumping out of that plane, I felt so close to God. Rabbi says, yeah, but you were going the wrong way afterwards. So the guy tells us he went shark hunting, and he went scuba diving, and he's mountain climbing, and he's going on. And my kids are all, their eyes are wide. He looks at me, he says, Rabbi, you're not impressed? I said, listen to me, I teach 8th grade, okay? All of that pales in comparison to one day. And I always listen to the way kids talk. And I think that as the years go on, this happens more and more. You know, no one is hungry anymore. What's the thing as a kid being hungry? I did not hear the word hungry the entire year. I did hear, I'm starving. We go straight to starving. Or, I'm starving to death. Heard that? There's no one hot anymore. It's never hot. It's never warm. It's boiling here. It's cooking. It's Gehenna. It's, you know, what rhymes with well, you know what I mean. Right? Because we're so used to everything being our way. You know, they say Rav Moshe Feinstein, the great sage, for many years refused to have an air conditioner in his room. Because he asked him why. He says when he sits down to learn Torah, he wants to learn without an air conditioner. I said, why? He lived in the Lower East Side, you know, not on the North Pole. It gets hot there. So he said, because what if the air conditioner breaks? Then I won't be able to study Torah. I said, oh, without air conditioning, we can't function. So I want to get used to doing it without the air conditioning. What was he really teaching us? He was really teaching us a reality in life. We're raised in a society, we're raised in a culture where we're given to believe the world is yours. And then when we find out that the world is not ours, we're very depressed. But if we can train ourselves to start with, guess what? The world is not ours, then the world would be a very different place. You know, this past Friday, according to some opinions, was considered a tanit, was considered a fast day. Why? It was because in the history of Klal Yisrael, about 960 years ago to be exact, there was the burning of the Talmud in France that took place. And I really don't want to get into a history lesson here, but I'm just going to make it very quick. There was an apostate Jew, his name was Nicholas Dunham. Dunham, a Jew wasn't allowed to own land in medieval Europe. Dunham wanted to own land. He became very close with the French echelons, higher echelon French in the French society. And as a result, he slowly started drifting away from Judaism. And there was a great rabbi, the Rabbeinu Yechiel Meperis, who told Dunham, stop it. You can't have it both ways. You're either a Jew or you're not. And he was very radical, and the two of them had it out with each other. And once he came into the synagogue and he stood there, and the Rabbeinu Yechiel Meperis stood up there and said, Danan, if you want to be a Jew, you're welcome. If you don't, please step out, because you're misleading people. And he said, if I don't step out, what are you going to do to me? So he said, I'm going to excommunicate you. And the rabbi went on to talk what excommunication means, which means you now stand within his four amot. He said, you can do whatever you want. It's a free country. But don't say you're one thing when you're something else. And he left and he was terribly humiliated. And he ran to the king of France and he said that the Talmud is full of blasphemy against our religion and please have it all burnt. They want all of them to all, and the Louis, the King Louis did not want it to be burnt. And even the Pope did not want it to be burnt at that point. He said, leave it alone. And he kept pushing it. And he also demanded an expulsion of Jews from France. To think that today, normally when a guy gets upset in the synagogue, he just goes out and joins a different synagogue. I mean, in those days it was much more complicated. Now, things went from bad to worse, and Dunham had to call the Rabbeinu Yechiel Meperis, the rabbi of Paris, to a debate. The debate was a very tough situation. Because if you answered too sharply in a debate, you could have been imprisoned right there and then. If you didn't answer enough, then you lost the debate. You were really skating on thin ice. And he came to the debate, and he stood there. You know, they say an old story, that once there was a Jew, some of the troublemakers in town called the Jewish rabbi to a debate. They're going to debate religion. The rabbi didn't want to go. He says, well, listen, you do your thing, I do my thing, leave me alone. He said, no, you have to. And the Jews didn't know what to do. So the town water carrier got up, Groinen, that was his name, he said, I'll go, I'll debate him. You'll debate him, you don't know how to read or write, you don't know anything. He says, don't worry, let me go. He says, if I go, you have nothing to lose. If the rabbi loses, it's a big thing. And if the rabbi wins, we can get in trouble. By me, it's a no-lose situation. If I win, so you're going to say, wow, the water carrier, able to. If I lose, you know, so I'm just the water carrier. So they said, fine, you can go. So he goes and they lay down the groundwork for the debate. What's the groundwork for the debate? Groundwork for the debate is as follows. Whoever the first one, you're going to ask each other questions. The first one that says, I don't know, that person loses the debate. So he goes and says, they ask the water carrier, first question. He asks the person he's debating with, he says, you know Hebrew? Yes. Tell me, translate the words, Eino yodea in Hebrew. The guy says, I don't know. He says, ha, you lost the debate. So everyone runs to the water carrier to say, wow, what an ingenious thing. How did you think of that? You know, he wasn't known to have the greatest IQ. He says, well, I was looking for a really hard word, and I opened up a chumash, a Bible with translation, and I figured if even they didn't know what the translation was, so surely I'm going to use it against him. What do you mean they don't know? He says, I don't know. I looked up a word, and it said, I don't know. So I figured if he doesn't know, this must be a hard word, right? But the debates were very serious. The Ramban in Nachmanides in the 1600s had to run for his life. He came to Jerusalem after winning a debate. It was you were pretty much stuck between a rock and a hard place. And pogroms often followed debates. It was a very serious situation. And the Rabbeinu Yechiel worked it through. He worked it through, and the Jews survived. And Dunham this time went to the Pope, and he began screaming. He was really angry because he was humiliated. And push came to shove, and at the end, on the Friday of Parshas Chukat, it doesn't go on the calendar date. They took 24 wagon loads of sifarim of the Talmud and they burnt them. In a public burning, many Jews were so upset, they felt the Torah is over, they wanted to jump into the fire, they were held back. They have to realize what that meant to burn a volume of the Talmud in those days. That's today, you know, every bar mitzvah boy comes back with 50 wagon loads of sifarim. In those days, you had a parchment, and you had a quill, and you had to write. If you wanted to learn in the yeshiva of Rashi, you have to spend a year writing a Gemara on felt and on parchment that was taken off from an animal and processed and dried. And you have to write with a quill pen. I remember in my days as a kid, anyone remember that they had those little holes in the desks because they used to have fill it up with ink and dip, that's how the kids would write? I don't know, my 8th grade class, I can't imagine if there would be a bottle of ink on everyone's desk. When they burnt that Talmud, everyone said the Torah is over. Every single copy of the Talmud, every Jewish Bible was destroyed in the fire. And Rabbeinu Yechiel came home that night, and you know what he did? He started rewriting the Shas. He told every single one of his Talmidim the night before, you memorize this page, you memorize this page, you memorize this page. And each and every one of them memorized a different page. And as a result, they rewrote the entire Shas. There is on Tisha B'Av, on the ninth day of Av, a special lamentation that we say about the burning of the Shas. But my question is, why did we say it on Tisha B'Av? Why didn't we say it last Friday if that's when it happened? So I once heard a beautiful explanation. On Tisha B'Av, we cry that the Gemaras were burnt. We cry at the pain of Jews. The Tanit on the day that it happened is not because we're crying that it happened. The Tanit on the day that it happened is because God looked down. He called all the angels and said, look at those rabbis. Look what they did. Every available copy of the Talmud and Torah has been burnt. He should have just thrown in his towel and called it quits. And he said, no, we're going to build, we're going to teach. I'm going to reteach. There is a moment in your life that your Gemaras are burnt. There is a moment in the life of every Jew that he feels he's going through an emotional crisis. He's going through a situation where he feels all of his Sefarim has been taken away from him. He's gone. I can never learn again. I can never deal with God again. Not after I went through. Not after what happened to me. And at that moment, your whole life is on the balance. Because what you could do is, you can say, I have no Gemara. I start. I lost the appointment. I make the Shahakol. I don't have to know how it's going to work. All I know is I have to try. That's what God wants from us. And I'm going to conclude with the following. About 30 years ago, when I was in yeshiva, there was a chatan, there was four or five boys that were supposed to get married within a month or two. There was a terrible tragedy. One boy got sick. He went to the doctor for a routine checkup before he got married. He got sick. He died. And it was a terrible tragedy. There was another bride who dropped the wedding for whatever reason a week before. And the boy tried to commit suicide. There was one guy left that was still going to get married, and he was very, very concerned. And I met him one day, we'll call him Shlomo. And I said, Shlomo, what's the matter? He says, I'm petrified, I'm out of my mind, I'm supposed to get married next week, who knows if I'll ever get married. He says, you'll get married, don't worry. He says, see what's going on in yeshiva? I'm the next one on the line. He says, no, I think you need some help. There was a fellow in yeshiva, he was a therapist. I said, can you talk to Shlomo? He says, Shlomo, sit down. He says, and for some reason I was invited to this session. They take out a piece of paper. He says, do me a favor, write down what you're worried about. He says, I'm worried the cow is going to drop the shidduch. What if my bride says she's not going to marry me? I said, that's fine. What else are you worried about? He says, I'm worried. What else are you worried about? I'm worried about crazy things. I'm so embarrassed, I can't even say it. Say it! I'm worried that on my way to the wedding, I'm getting married in Connecticut, the car will get a flat. That's your problem? Write it down. What else are you worried about? I'm worried about a terrorist attack on that day. I'm worried there'll be a storm. The highways will be closed. I'm worried if I get sick. I'm worried that my bride will drop the shidduch. I said to him, couldn't hold myself back. I said, if she realizes what you're worried about, she may just drop the shidduch for good reason. He says, I want you to put it all down on paper, okay? He puts it all down on paper. He says, okay. Now, I want you to write down the percentages. What are the chances of getting a flat tire? 1%. 99%, you get no flat tire. You never get flat tires unless you're late for a meeting. Next. What are the percentages of a storm? 1%, 99%, you hear it's not going to happen. What are the percentages not going to happen? Finally, you see this whole list? All these crazy things you're worried about? 1%, 1%, it's not going to happen. 99%, 99%, it's only 1% chance of it happening. 99% chance of it's not happening. Stop worrying about it. Okay, he stops worrying about it. Great. He goes home, he calls me up, he's petrified. He says, I took out the list, I start adding up. 1% chance of a flat tire, 2% chance of a storm, 1% chance of this. I says, I added up. I added a bunch of things because of 300% chance I'm not going to get married. He says, I'm going out of my mind. I say to him, finally, I'm talking to him. It's in yeshiva in the morning. A man comes by and he's selling tickets to a goral. He's selling tickets to a Megillah. Whoever wins the Megillah gets the ticket. I say, you know what? I have a great idea. I bought him a raffle ticket. I said to the guy, how many tickets are you selling? He said, he's selling 500 tickets. Fine. I said, I want you to call your father-in-law and tell him you just won a Megillat, because Megillat Esther, because I gave you a ticket. He says, you're crazy? He sold 500 tickets. What are the chances of me winning? I said, ha, got you there, right? He says, 1 out of 500. So what are you worried about? A flat tire, it's also 1 out of 500. You wouldn't call your father-in-law, tell him Mazel Tov, you got a thing, right? I says, no, you're right. He calmed down. I'm more proud of myself. That's without a degree in psychiatry. That's all. Fine. About 6 weeks goes by, everything is hunky-dory. One night I get a call, come to the house, I said, what happened? I said, you know, Shlomo just got a call. I said, oh no, don't tell me she really called and dropped the shidduch. He says, no. I said, what happened? He can't talk. His mother comes, I says, you know what happened? I says, what happened? He says, somebody called, said, hello, your name is Shlomo so-and-so. He says, yes. Telephone number, yes. Mazel Tov, you want a Megillah? He goes, oh no, oh no. goes out of his mind. He says, I can't believe this. No, no, no. He says, hello. The guy does the other guy. I didn't tell you you just got ordered it from the IRS. I told you that you won a Megillah. Finally, this is it. He says, I'm finished. I'm gone. I'm dead. It's all over. There's no shidduch. I said, what does this teach me? I said, it teaches you don't listen to me for advice. That's what it teaches. So the next day, I take him to the rabbi, our rabbi, the mashgiach of our yeshiva. We sit down and we tell him the whole story from beginning to end. Rabbi says to him, okay, tell me what you're worried about. Rabbi, we went through this. It doesn't work with him. Tell me what you're worried about. He starts again with the flat tire. I said, oh no, not again with the flat tire. The rabbi says to him, you know what? It's very possible that you're going to get a flat tire. Hello, whose side are you on? What else are you worried about? I'm worried about, I might get sick. Rabbi says, it's possible. What else are you worried about? Terrorist attack. Could happen. What else are you worried about? A storm that's going to block the highway? Could happen. I had a hard time with that one, but... So he goes, so Rabbi, what are you trying to tell me? So I'm trying to tell you, get something straight in your mind, okay? There's only one question here. If God wants your chuppah to be on time, it's going to be on time. It won't be a second late. If God does not want your chuppah to be on time, then you can take a freight train of extra spare ties. It's not going to help you. It's just not going to happen. But you're trying to deal with mechanics. You're trying to deal with meteorologists. You're dealing with psychologists. You're dealing with doctors. You're dealing with 10,000 different people. You'll never coordinate all of that. You have this one question. Does God want your chuppah to be on time? If he wants it to be on time, everything else will be in order. If he doesn't want it to be on time, it won't help, whatever you're doing. So he goes, Rabbi, that means you yourself said, maybe God doesn't want my chuppah to be on time. So why should I buy a suit for my wedding? Could be throwing out the money. So he says to him, you know why you're buying a suit? You're not buying a suit because you're getting married, because only God knows if you're getting married. You're buying a suit because 3 weeks before your chuppah, your mitzvah is to buy a suit and to think positively. That's your mitzvah for today. Tomorrow, I don't know. My life isn't in my hands. I'm in God's hands. He says, why should I rent an apartment? Why should I put down security? Maybe I'm going to lose every penny I have. Because your mitzvah for today is to rent an apartment. 3 weeks before you get married, you find an apartment in Borough Park. This was 30 years ago. Today he would say 3 years before you get married, but okay. As long as you're going to try to pull enough buttons and speak to enough people and try to go to sleep at night saying, now I'm guaranteed all my problems are not going to happen. It'll never happen. When you come to terms of the fact, guess what? Your hands in the hands of your life is in the hands of God. That's all. Then you'll be relaxed. Then you'll enjoy life. And he did. And this is the greatest tzara with our society. No, he got married on time. His kids got married on time. We're not raised with this thought in our mind. It may just not work out. I know I told you that was the last story. That was like the last mashal story. This is really the last story, you know, honestly. It was a young girl. Her mother was very ill. And Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld, the Rav of Yerushalayim, passed by. And he saw what was happening. Her mother was ill. The Chevra Kedisha, the burial society, was there. And they carried... Finally, the father came out and said, take the little girl to nursery school. It's her first day. Who should take her? One of the brothers took her. Grabbed her by her pigtails, flew her like a kite, dumped her in. She's crying. It's the first day of school. All the mothers are standing there. They're running. Every time the kid sneezes, the mother comes flying in through the window. I just happened to be passing by. You know, are you okay? And at night, all the little kids are coming home. And the morad, the teacher, says, oh, your child is the most cutest child in the world. And this little girl, Hanala, is crying. And she says, what's the matter? And her brother comes to pick her up. And she says, but I want my mommy to pick me up. And the teacher says, I'll walk you home. No, I want my mommy to walk me home. And they take her home, and she sits on the front stoop, and no one has time for her. They were busy with the mother who was harboring on the brink of life or death, and the situation is really going. And the tzaddik Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld, the rabbi of Yerushalayim, passes by, and he says to her, why are you crying, Chana? And she says, I want my mommy to take me to school tomorrow. And the rabbi says to her, I give you a bracha that your mommy will take you to your chuppah. She goes, I don't want that. I want my mommy to take me to kindergarten. The years went on. She grows older. She's now 16 years old, which in Jerusalem was of age. And all the shatchanim, the matchmakers, start reading their old shidduchim. You know, shatchan is Roshei Tevot, Sheker Dover, Kesev Nikach, right? That takes... well, you don't want to hear the interpretation. It's better if it goes uninterpreted. Anyway, She's not, her father says to her, you have a sick mother, you're a girl, everyone wants you, you're a tznua, you're wonderful, you're attractive, what's the problem? Evi Shiduch, no, his nose is too long, his nose is too short, he's too tall, he's too short, too much money, too little money, no. Finally she says, your younger siblings are right behind you, they have to get married. Let them get married before me. Unheard of in Jerusalem. Every single one of her younger siblings gets married before her. She is now a girl, 22 years old. Very difficult to get married in Jerusalem. It's very hard to explain. But it was the equivalent of being 42 or 52 or 62. Finally she gets married to a man that was divorced. She's happy. The day after the Sheva Brachot, her mother passes away. She comes to the funeral. She throws herself down. She cries, Mama, don't you understand? She says, the rabbi gave me a blessing. That you should bring me to my chuppah. But I wanted my siblings to have that blessing also. That's why I didn't want to get married before you. I once heard a beautiful explanation. A bracha is only as good as you make yourself vulnerable. If she would have grabbed it for what it is, great, I have an insurance policy. The rabbi who was holy said, my mother's going to bring me to my chuppah. Who says it would have worked? Every blessing works. A blessing is a good, it pushes them in the right direction. But when you say a blessing, no, I want to give that away. I don't want to control my life. I don't need guarantees. Who has guarantees? I want to take what I have and I want to help somebody else with it. Then your blessing is guaranteed. The moment that chatan said, my chuppah is in your hands, God, then his chuppah was guaranteed. We live a life where we think it's ours. The moment we realize there's no guarantee from today to tomorrow, God, my life is in your hands, then you and I and all of us have a guarantee that our chuppah and the great chuppah of all times will be on time.